dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002, and goes out at noon every Tuesday here on BCFM 93.2. This week, freed from the shackles of BCFM and the time limit, because we've been suspended, actually dropped completely from BCFM's schedule. This week we talked to Sabine McNeil about child sexual abuse. We also talked to John Morgan, the very sick chap who's just written several books on the Diana assassination. Also to Paul Saville, who's running for mayor next year here in Bristol. Dialect's produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol just off Queen's Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733 or visit them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. But to start this week, I'm joined by Paul Saville. Paul, how could I introduce you? How should I introduce you? I met you first, didn't I, when you were up at the University of West of England many years ago, protesting about fees and cuts. Must have been 2010 or 2011.
2010, tuition fee protests up at UWE,
But nowadays, what are you up to?
Well, I've literally just finished I run a small business down in town. I sell chai, tea, and that's what I'm doing at the moment.
Mostly around the Bear Pit, because I remember seeing you there earlier on.
Yeah, I was there today. Like, I don't make loads of money, but I'm quite happy in what I'm doing.
Are you able to pay the rent, that sort of thing?
Just.
Yeah.
Every month. I just get to the end of the month, and it's just... Normally 2 days before I've done enough to pay the rent.
So you're spending almost all your hours just able to pay the rent. Can you do much more?
I could do more, but for me it's kind of trying to find a balance between working and living, not just existing. But I'm doing okay, you know, and I get to meet lots of interesting people along the way. So that's the main part for me.
Great. Well, I've asked you in today to talk about the way that the open spaces in Bristol are being used.
Yeah.
These are really in the custody of Bristol City Council. One of the statistics I've learnt over the years is that Bristol City Council, as a proportion of its land, has more in its own ownership than any other local authority in Britain. So, I mean, for example, they've just been selling off property in Portishead, things like that, off to the highest bidder, because that's not actually part of Bristol City Council area. So what is it that bugs you about the way that our parks are being used in the city?
Basically, it's public space, the way I see it, limited public space, especially in the city centre, like Queen's Square. You've got Castle Park. What else? We've got Brandon Hill. Around the corner, you've got King's Square, which is not particularly brilliant or big, but it's another public space which is green, you know. What I've seen, I mean, not just this summer, but in previous summers, is these public spaces being turned into private property, private property. Often with big Harris fencing set up, you know, private events happening, which is fine. You know, they're paying their way and stuff. But then basically, there's this time where they're setting up. So say the events for three nights. Either side of that, there's 4 days of setting up and packing down. So you've basically seen, say for example, Queen's Square shut for 4 days before. Two days for the festival. Say, and then 4 days. That's what is 10 days. 10 days for pack down, event and pack up again. Which means that all of that time, that public space has been lost. And this summer, I counted seven events, which were open to public, but you know you had to pay to be there, and it was largely focused around alcohol. There was a Magna's cider comedy event. There was a Thai festival. There's a Harbourside festival, which is a story in itself, with all of the outside businesses coming into Bristol and leaving a right mess in Bristol Green Capital. But like I said, another story. And essentially, it's our spaces, not the council spaces. That's my main kind of gripe with it, is that it's our space to decide what goes on with it, not just head honchos in Bristol City Council.
Well, I know journalist Anna Minton has written a fantastic book called Ground Control about this, which is, I mean, we all know, or at least if we've had a decent education, we know about the history of privatisation in the countryside, where the countryside used to be villages, open field system, the idea being that the whole of the village was shared by the whole of the village, pretty much, and the land was used like giant allotments
And there was also land always to graze livestock. Like, we've still got a bit of a vestige of this. Say, if you, for example, if you go up to Old Land Common or even a bit further away to Stroud, around there, Minchin Hampton, you'll see anybody that lives in Minchin Hampton, if they've got a sheep or a cow, they can just leave it on the common and they can use it to graze it on the common. This is actually the way land was originally used. Slowly but surely, through the enclosures, mostly accelerating after the English Civil War in the 1600s, that was all privatised to make way for, hey guys, sheep. You know, most of the time it was sheep that took over. The people were evicted from the land. But that sort of thing is now happening in the cities too, isn't it? I mean, you look at, for example, at Cabot Circus, all the streets around there that used to be open to the public is now private policing.
Well, designed to look like public space, but actually private property, you know.
They track your mobile phone as well. As soon as you arrive at Cabot Circus, your mobile phone is being tracked. They're watching what you're doing.
That's their rules.
What about the argument, though, that I'm sure that the council will be putting, saying, well, we're putting on events for the public?
Sure, yeah, and that's fine. That's not my argument. My argument really is that, number one, it's up to the public to decide. And secondly, you know, people who live in... Right, so basically, if you live in a city centre, you're going to have limited space anyway. You're often going to be living in a hamster cage flat. If you're paying enough or lucky enough, you might have a garden, but probably not. So for people living in the centre who are paying upwards of 600, the rent's gone through the roof now in the city centre, BS1. For people living in those properties, they don't have green space to go and sit in. So for me, when I was working this summer, you know, people were kind of like wandering around the edges of the perimeter of Queen Square, for example, just to have their own little, you know, bit of green space. And
actually, if you don't get enough green space, it does drive you mad. Yeah. That is official. I remember this is a few years ago, looking at a survey of monkeys, and they found that if the monkeys got past a certain density, then they would start killing each other.
Right.
So I think humans do behave in this similar way. If you start stacking them in and don't give them any open space to breathe, where they can mentally breathe and they sort of extend their minds a little bit, that's what happens. People start going mad.
I don't think it's in Bristol City Council's interests, generally speaking, these days, to actually be looking out for people in Bristol. They're more about the commercial interests. And I mean, Ferguson aside, you know, you've got these service directors who are they're just Tories. They're completely set on making money out of Bristol for private interests.
Well, I must admit, I mean, I recently interviewed George Ferguson and asked him, do you think you can run Bristol like a business? And he took a big gulp, and it was like a difficult thing for him to answer because he's there.
Yeah.
He's saying to the public, but he's saying to all his business friends, yes, we can run this place like a business.
Yeah,
well, what's the problem if they if they do run it as a business?
Did he swear at you? Lucky you.
He's very polite and fairly polite. He called me Conspiracy Tony.
All right.
Because apparently I'm asking silly questions.
Too many questions.
Anyway, you're actually getting political, aren't you? You're intending to stand for mayor next year. Why have you decided to do that, Paul?
I mean, one of the biggest things for me at the moment, personally, like, I'm seeing where I'm working, I'm seeing a lot of the issues in Bristol firsthand. And there's we had it before, but there's the biggest problem of homelessness. If you go down to Castle Park, for example, on an evening, you'll meet the underbelly of Bristol. You know, the things that people don't see, the hidden homeless. You know, lots of people sleeping out rough still. And, you know, I mean, I think Ferguson was asked the question the other day by the Evening Post, is, you know, are Bristol City Council doing enough to deal with poverty? And absolutely not. Because if you go and look at the real Bristol, away from the shiny five-star hotels and stuff, then there's a big, big problem.
But there's also a lot of people sleeping in their cars, aren't there? I know up on the Downs, police have been sort of knocking on their doors and saying, go somewhere else.
Yeah, right.
But we've got an official figure around about 15,000 homeless. Mm. Unofficially, talking to some of the council officials, they were saying that they've got 20,000, 19,500 on their homelessness. They're building about 5, I think.
Yeah.
Something like that.
The main thing for me really is that quite a few of us have had a chat about it, and I would like to stand. I think we want to take the platform really and start to address some of the things that we think are on the agenda for Bristolians really. And I think like a lot of it will be kind of washed over by the other candidates. There'll be some interesting things brought up in that, I think, and I want to be involved in that debate really.
Do you believe in politics? A lot of people have given up on it, Paul.
Well, it depends what you mean really by politics. I believe in people, and I believe that. Jeremy Corbyn coming to Bristol tomorrow. You know, I mean, no, I don't know. I still believe in it in a general sense. I think, you know.
Yeah, because the thing is, as soon as you don't believe in it, you start to get the sort of situation that creates civil unrest because people are just not being represented, and so they start getting angry.
Yeah.
Also with the parks, don't you accept that people have actually got some benefit from this? Some people have gone along, they've had a great time.
Sure, yeah, and I've met lots of those people as well. And for me, it's not about saying oh, don't have any fun. It's the opposite. It's like who's having fun at whose expense?
I suppose the question is, for a lot of the commercial businesses who are coming in and carrying out these events, why can't they just hire a commercial venue?
Well, that's, you know, interesting you say that, Tony, because I was chatting to one of these events, or the high-vis people on the front gate sort of thing, one day at Queen Square, and I did bring that up. I said, well, if it's a private event, why can't it happen in a private space? For example, at Bristol, you know, they've got the big thing there. Why take the limited public space and turn it into private property when it's, you know, few and far between anyway?
So what did they say?
I'm just doing my job.
Don't ask me. I'll tell you what, I'll give you an answer. It's cheaper.
Yeah.
The council probably just say,
it's
well...
It's a backhander, isn't it?
Well, it might be. I mean, also it might be favours for friends because, of course, a lot of the city councillors do mingle with the business elite, don't they? I mean, I'm not sure what you think, but it seems to me that there's almost like an unofficial political party, the business elite, represent.
I think it's quite visible as well, though, you know. I mean, this... what's it called? I don't want to get it correct, but the Business West, the Bristol 2015 and, you know, the 2050. I remember reading something about that.
Yeah, they've got Bristol 2050 vision, haven't they? And they've decided what they want the future to be. Yeah. Business West have. They also get big government subsidies, which they then dish out, as well as the local enterprise partnership, dishing out government money to themselves.
Yeah.
So... a political party in the background. Mm. It's almost like, well, George Ferguson's from that area, isn't he? He's an ex-merchant venturer himself. He knows all these people. He's friendly with these people. Even though he says he's independent, is he really?
Well, the independent thing's interesting because, like I said, I'm going to run for mayor. And what I've been told is actually I need to set up a political party to be involved in that debate. The reason why apparently Ferguson was involved in the debates and my friend Dave Dobbs, Rich Fisher, weren't allowed into the hustings was because they were independents, just the same as Ferguson. But Ferguson had the information to say you need to set up Bristol First, the political party, so he could be involved in those hustings. Otherwise, I'll be stood outside handing out leaflets, you know, to people who just don't know I even exist.
Okay, so is the Bristol Second? What do you think? Or Bristol even more first?
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll see. Brilliant. See how you get on next year. Thanks very much for joining us on Dialect, Paul.
Nice to see you, Tony.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And I'm joined back by Sabine McNeill now from London, who's a campaigner mainly actually around the child sexual abuse scandal. Sabine, first of all, your earlier incarnation, at least when I first got to know you, was around something called the Forum for Stable Currencies. And I know that you're really bothered about the way that money's now used on a personal and an international level to control the population, to control people, and actually to interfere with politics. What are your thoughts about how that actually operates? What are you worried about here?
What I'm worried about is that nobody knows the truth about money as what it is. Vince Cable once said that to me himself. No, it is not being taught at places like the LSE. Instead, there is a pseudoscience called economics that is used to cover up what bankers are doing and central bankers. No, hardly anybody knows about the national debt as the mechanism to control governments financially. And politicians don't know. So the growth of interest on debt is not understood. So the whole situation is about using money as control and for control rather than as a medium of exchange to facilitate trade, what it was once upon a time invented for. And that you just mentioned the Volkswagen story. I mean, it is so horrendous. I have been, I must talk about my case because I've been gagged after 2 months of bail conditions. I've been given another three months, but I don't have my benefits my pension reinstated. So, you know, I'm expected to live off begging, and with a bit of luck, my landlord may succeed in getting me evicted after 30 years in the same flat. Let's hope that that won't be the case. It would be a long, drawn-out process, I was assured. But, I mean, nobody cares about anybody. And money is certainly more of a stick than of a carrot.
That's right. I mean, you're looking at... I don't want to get you to talk necessarily too much about your case. Obviously, you've signed bail conditions and things, but one would have hoped that if you've signed those, then you'd start getting your rights back. But obviously, that doesn't seem to be happening. It does seem, doesn't it, that the money system has gone from a situation, you were saying there, you're applying it anyway, that the system, the money system, should serve the population, should serve the public, should serve the citizenry. It seems now it's almost the other way around.
Absolutely, absolutely. It is the elite and those who have the power to create money and who have enough to influence enough, and everything is only in people's private, in those people's private interest, nothing in the public interest anymore whatsoever, I don't think.
We also had the whole situation with Greece. I think it was Finian Cunningham, the Irish writer who writes for globalresearch.ca and various other websites. Finian pointed out he was using the term Panzer banks, saying that the German Panzer banks were destroying Greece. I mean, is that fair to say? Because this is almost like a hearkening back to the Second World War. It's just that rather than actual physical tanks, that the country can be taken over, or a country can be taken, a company, an industry, a part of infrastructure can be taken over by bankers without actually firing a shot.
Yes, 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 because it's about control, it's about governance, it's whoever has the purse strings, you know, whoever determines the fate over others. But I mean, the sad thing with Greece is, of course, that there were not enough people clearly who told them that they should print their own drachma again. You know, in theory, that's what should have happened in Germany again, that they went back to the mark. But I happened to have seen at the time a film on telly about how the euro was introduced. Tony, it was like a military operation. The tanks and the security about, you know, taking the marks out and bringing the euros in. You could tell it's just not nothing by the people, for the people. For God's sake, that's the last thing.
So countries like Norway, Switzerland, Britain did the right thing by not getting involved in the euro, do you think?
Well, at least, yes. I mean, especially as small countries, they can still kind of see a little bit better what's happening. But, of course, the principle is still the same, that money is not the kind of currency that one experiences when one sets up a scheme or is part of a professional barter company. That's when you realize how currency gets created by mutually consenting adults agreeing to the value of a trade and exchange of a service or a product. That is, to me, the ultimate, if you like, purity of money. And if things go well with my software developments, that's what I will want to create, sort of cyber money and digital money, which is honest and real and a genuine medium of exchange where genuine rewards are made, and not where somebody has the monopoly to create it and then lends it at interest, over interest, and creates myths around growth that are just completely fantasy. They can't be real, can't be maintained. But
well, it's good to hear Jermaine Greer on Question Time earlier this year, I think it was January 2015, actually saying to the Greeks, well, look, if you can get away with defaulting on your debt and survive it, then good luck to you, she's saying.
Yes, exactly. I mean, why on earth should any debt be just like a kind of a whip all the time, you know? But then that's what was introduced after World War II. I remember my father talking about that as well also. You know, the whole Marshall Plan, that was the debt. So first the country gets destroyed and then we lend you money to build you up again and so that you can pay all of your interests. Thank you very much. I mean, on that level, there are clearly a few people who know what is happening and has happened. But it's all too much. I suffer from too muchness. Tony, I spoke with Christopher Booker at length the other day, and he said, the trouble is we've lived too long. And I said, no, we haven't lived long enough to make enough of a difference yet.
Yeah, well, that's true. It's a bit bizarre having to talk to you with this gagging order. I'm sure there's quite a lot you can say. Maybe you could just begin by sketching out what you're not allowed to talk about.
I'm not allowed to talk about my arrest, and I'm not allowed to talk about the particular case that I made public via a couple of petitions and a website, and in particular the names of whom I call the innocent abusers, because they are the ones who approach the police and they feel harassed by whatever, by accusing me of having published something that I didn't publish. And after 2 months of bail conditions of this kind, the police claims that they haven't managed to analyze my telephones and the USB stick that they confiscated and need 3 more months because there are so many terrorists out there and therefore there are so many digital devices that need to be analyzed.
Well, this is something that's happened quite a lot over the years, isn't it, where people who are actually campaigning for justice for children abused, sexually abused often, are actually pulled in by the police and treated as criminals themselves.
You see, this is when it depends whom I'm talking to, but I tend to cry when I then have to say that I am treated like a criminal. It is just the shock of the arrest.
There's been quite a lot been going on, nevertheless, though, in the public domain, Sabine. I mean, I know Panorama a couple of weeks ago had a program on which was really purporting to say, well, hang on, the accusations of a VIP paedophile ring, they had various so-called witnesses on there, in fact, two or three. Strangely, they were probably the most shaky witnesses that there are in the entire country. And why is it that Panorama are putting these really shaky witnesses and using them as evidence to say effectively that there is no VIP paedophile ring?
Oh, because the whole exercise is one of denial, 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 and cover up, and cover up, and cover up. That is the tragedy. And it's really sad because they, for some reason or other, they still think they can get away with it. But they clearly didn't realize the power of the internet and that and how they are losing credibility by the minute and the day. So the fact that the BBC keeps being pulled in, that was the case in the Amstel scandal as well, kind of that Panorama does it now as well, is sort of just another sign of the fact that they keep trying. But I don't think for 1 minute that they'll get away with it forever and ever.
Yes, it seems to be a sort of temporary exercise in order to maybe put a bit of a cloud over the situation for a few weeks. And that's all that seems to be possible. I mean, the thing is, we know, don't we, in public, Sir Peter Hayman, he was one of the top civil servants in Britain. He was deputy head of the Secret Intelligence Service, MI6. He was the governor, I believe, or deputy governor of Canada. And yet he was a paedophile. And yet there was Panorama, don't mention that. There's also the fact that the IPC are looking into something like 30 cases now of accusations, many of which are made by former police officers, special branch officers, who said that they were conducting criminal investigations and they had the higher-ups, that is to say MI5, the Home Office, the Security Service people, come in and close those investigations down. Just to add to that, we had on LBC, the London radio station, just last week, a former detective phoned in to LBC I mean, I imagine he's also gone to the authorities as well. But this is almost the last port of call that people can just phone into a radio station and live on the air explain what they were involved in. And he was saying there was a whole team in East London back in the 1980s who were just about to swoop on a massive paedophile ring, which involved very high-profile figures, that is, you know, obviously connected with this VI paedophile scandal. And the night before it happened, there was a tap on the shoulder from a chief superintendent of some sort who said, well, I've just been told we've got to stop this investigation because some of the evidence might not be rigorous enough. So they'd spent months and months doing all this investigation, were about to swoop and having loads of arrests, and were told literally a few hours before the raids, no, we're not going to do these raids. So how can Panorama get away with doing something which is saying this is all going away? It just seems that more and more people are making their evidence public, Sabine.
Yes, I agree. I've just sent you the link to an article published by Anonymous. MI5 bribed politician paedophile, says independent probe, in case you haven't seen that. Well, I suppose you must say they are just doing their job. They must keep trying. But one of the key players is clearly the police. And in Australia, New South Wales, there was a Royal Commission in 1996, which had as a title then Corruption, Reform, Paedophilia, and contained also 17 pages on satanic ritual abuse. So I spoke to the guy who gave me that link at the time at length recently again, and he was the one who also pointed this whole problem of child snatching out in the first place. And he accompanied one where Dame Butler Slosh, when she happened to have been the head of the family division, exported, as I called it, a child to Australia. And my friend was very, very closely involved. You had him on your program recently, Peter Oakes.
He's
the one. And he has all of the evidence of this particular case. And when I mentioned it to Christopher Booker, he said, well, what capacity was Dame Butler Slosh in? He said, oh, well, and so I checked with Peter. She was in charge of the family courts division. So she was then what then was Sir Nicholas Wall, who sent the Musas to prison for 7 years. And now Sir James Manby, who at least tries to make a difference, but of course he's being ignored. But Peter keeps saying and pointing out that and how the police are the ones who have the power to blackmail, who run the pornography business, who run the drugs dealers, and who are, if you like, basically on the ground and therefore can do what they like because they are always sufficiently protected. And recently I sat next to a woman who had retired from the police, and I asked her, because she was in human resources, and she said, well, yes, especially when it's higher up, when higher up people are involved, that's when it gets really corrupt.
And then we've got another news story the last few days. Last couple of weeks, I think it would be fair here, is that one of the top advisors in the Home Office about drugs has been arrested for himself being a crack cocaine dealer. I can remember back, I mean, this is probably the 1990s now, and I can't remember for the life of me the author, but the book was called The Filth. He was a former drug squad officer at Scotland Yard, and he said that Scotland Yard was the best organised, when it came to drugs, best organised criminal gang in the country. They were involved in all this stuff at a very deep level. So there's drugs in there. There's also there's paedophilia. But I just want to get down to talk about MI5 a bit and Special Branch, because the organisation, I mean, a lot of people don't actually understand what Special Branch is. They're basically sort of political police that are attached to and part of the regional police forces. That is to say, like the Metropolitan Police have got their own special branch as part of that. But they do the liaison with MI5. So it's not surprising that so many special branch officers, former special branch officers, have come forward to the IPCC making formal complaints about their investigations being interfered with, because they're the people, they're the link. They're actually, in a way, the key people who could probably blow this scandal out of the water, because they're the ones that can see what the police forces are doing and also, on the other side, see what MI5 are doing. These people are absolutely key witnesses in the future when it comes to bringing the paedophiles to trial.
Well, that'll be terrific, won't it? I can't wait, I must say.
Do you think it's going to happen? I mean, you know, ultimately
something has to happen. I don't know what. I won't predict. I mean, quite frankly, Tony, I am much more concerned to give compensation to victims that I don't need to see the paedophiles hanging by the droves. You know, because they keep, whatever punishment you give them, they keep going on and doing it anyway. So it doesn't matter. The question is, how can we genuinely protect them and kind of turn this whole organization round, which is supposedly there to protect, but actually is completely set up for their benefits. Let's call a spade a spade. And that's what I find so absolutely obnoxious. You know, this is sort of interesting, if you like. On one end, you've got the abuse survivors, but on the other end of the spectrum, you've got the 1,000 children being taken a month. And 4% of those being forcibly adopted. As a little trophy or victory, thank God at least 10 MEPs are going to come to London on November 5th and 6th for a fact-finding mission. Now, they've done this to Germany and Denmark as well before and may not make a difference either. But there is also a report out by a Duma member, Olga Borzhova, who calls the practices in the UK abusive. And maybe something is going to give in the kind of harmonization across the European countries, because what's going on is just really the culling of the population by starting with the children for the benefit of the paedophiles. I mean, excuse me, this is just not on.
This whole thing of satanic ritual abuse or ritual abuse, this is one of the things that puzzles me, because there's plenty of evidence for it. There is the psychological purpose of it really being to utterly traumatized children so that they don't want to talk about it. That's the purpose. And yet publications like Private Eye deny that there's any evidence for it whatsoever. I mean, what is going on there?
I don't know why this. I think the denial comes basically from anybody who just doesn't want to stretch their imagination into the horrificness.
There's a sort of psychology here. It's almost built in to the abuse itself is its own kind of excuses why people don't want to deal with it.
Yeah, the satanic panic. You can't believe anything if you can't imagine it. Well, you don't want to imagine what is as horrible as this. But when you see the little kids talking about it, you know, one of the video titles I put to it was called Papa Kills Babies, you know. I mean, who wants to know about that? People get seriously affected.
But surely, I mean, if I was a police officer, I would want to know about it, and I would be going around to go and pay Papa a visit.
Well, not if you are named by the children and are part of the gang, I'm afraid.
So you think that there are police officers involved with the gang?
Yes.
Is there actually any evidence for that?
Yeah, well, The children are the evidence.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? I mean, the thing is, of course, look, Sabine, I mean, this is bound to be what people are thinking hearing this is simple, isn't it? This is almost like a kind of potential witch hunt here. You can't rely on the evidence of these children alone. You need to have it properly corroborated. Otherwise, you're in a situation a little bit like, you know, the Crucible play, which talks about you know, the whole sort of witch hunt business, where that happens over in the United States. That's in the play, where kids are giving evidence that such and such is a witch, you know, and the authorities are going into a panic. It turns out actually what's going on is they're making it up.
Yes, but you see, I mean, I really have to be careful now, but the case was closed, crime not confirmed, and the investigation didn't take place. But recently, there was one of the activists who had been seriously arrested and gone to court. She won because two of the witnesses didn't dare to show up. And one of them was... Well, a person whom I'm not allowed to name, but then there's the Hammond Hyatt wrote about it. I mean, it is.
This case that you're not allowed to talk about, you can read about it in the Hammond High, which is a newspaper in Hampstead and Highgate.
The local paper, which wrote very bad articles about me and my colleague Belinda, to discredit us, but now they had to track back on this case that Nilo, the...
What I'll do is I will dig out a link to an article from the Ham and High, Sabine, and put it on the show page, because you're probably not allowed to talk much more about that case. Evidence, though, is there. It's also there. I noticed recently an interview from an Australian documentary maker. I think it's 60 Minutes is the name of the program. It's on Channel 9 in Australia. Yes. And this is back from the about, I think it was around about 1990, the early 1990s. They actually made a film about child sexual abuse going on in London. So that's amazing. I mean, I didn't know that. This is another form of corroboration that there's something real going on here.
Oh, yes. Well, the biggest thing was there was a Daily Mail article last year based on a UN report, which quotes that London is a child, the capital for child abuse and trafficking.
Well, it's also the capital of organised crime, we're told by a lot of people, to do with the financial sector. In other words, since the mid-early 1990s, the financial crime has been normal in London. In fact, that's what's attracted quite a lot of money to London, is because you can get away with financial crime here, and you know you're not going to be taken to court. You can do things like false accounting, which of course all the big the big four accounting companies do. So it seems that London is a bit of a centre, isn't it? And funnily enough, in the world of war as well, the sort of confrontation between East and West in Ukraine and Syria, London is also a key place. So, you know, this is seems to me as if maybe London is where a lot of this is going to be decided, Sabine. Would you agree?
Oh, definitely. And but do make the difference between the City of London and Westminster. But London as a whole, yes, as a source of children and as a playground for paedophiles. I have just looked again at the report for that somebody put together 3 years ago with data up to May 2012 about the number of non-UK kids in the care of UK social services. And Camden and Lambeth, Barnet and Camden are on position 8, 9 and 10, which I find quite peculiar, you know. And of course, Lambeth, Brian Peet is still in prison. He exposed a paedophile ring. And of course, Lambeth is near to Westminster. And, you know, Dolphin Square is not far. And the Elm Guest House is in the area. So it's all connected, isn't it?
Yeah, it does seem to be. I mean, at the end of the day, we're hoping there's going to be, you know, the judicial process will take its course. But I suppose there's the other side, which is, well, maybe the perpetrators will just create some kind of war, whether it's in the Middle East or in Eastern Europe, to distract attention.
Tony, I've often asked myself, which judge are we going to find who is going to condemn paedophiles? I mean, I'm told that there are lots of judges who are now leaving because they are expected to find homeless people with money. And one who did pay was sacked when he paid on behalf of a homeless person. I mean, you see, it's complete ludicrousness. It's either sex or money or both that kind of corrupts people individually and institutions, and institutions use either. And of course, war, as the ultimate madness of humans, has to be financed. But those who order the wars are never fighting them themselves, let alone be other victims like the children in the wars. I mean, I really can't cope anymore.
Yes, you can. Yes, you can. Look, I mean, the thing is, Sabine, I mean, we're in an interesting, I mean, you as a German citizen originally, anyway, I mean, I'm not sure what your citizenry is now, but I mean, we look at Germany now, don't we? In a way, it's almost like the roles have been reversed. Germany has stood up to the US and said, we're not interested in regime change in Syria. We think this is going to cause a lot of problems. The Russians are now backing up President Assad in Syria. And although the British seem to be on the coattails of the Americans wanting regime change, the Germans have stood up, haven't they? And they've said, no, we're not having it.
Well, yes, I do actually have German citizenship, and I've actually been told that it didn't make me English when I got married to an Englishman. And in fact, the one of the reasons why I don't get my pension credit reinstated was because I was all of a sudden, after 30 years, I'm told I don't have the right to reside in this country.
Oh, yes, they're doing that to a lot of people. I know, for example, here in Bristol, the leader of the Sikh community who's been here for, he's been the leader of the Sikh community for 10 years, he's suddenly been told your citizens' rights are being revoked. And you're going to have to go back to the I think he's in the Far East somewhere where his original home was. And so this is being used as a sort of excuse to disrupt communities.
It is just so sick.
It does seem like we've got a kind of criminal elite that are thrashing around because actually they're starting to lose it.
And maybe that must be the reason, because they can, they do it, and... they're starting to lose it. It would be a nice explanation.
Okay, anyway. Just remind us of your website again, Sabine.
victims-unite.net.
Okay, thanks very much for joining us again on Dialect.
Thank you for making me smile again, Tony.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
And I'm joined on the line now from Brisbane, Australia, by John Morgan, who's the author of several books on Princess Diana and her death. I think you probably call it more of an assassination, wouldn't you, John?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, Tony. There's no question once you do a full investigation into this... what occurred in Paris in August 1997, there's no question that this was an assassination. That's right.
What do you think, then, are the main points that you'd look at to say, well, hang on, this is what convinced me? Because maybe some people will look at you, John, and they'll say, well, you went out with the express intention of finding an assassination, and that's what often happens in investigations, or whoever, journalists, is they find what they're looking for.
Yeah, that's true. Well, the thing that got me interested in this was in 2003 when Paul Burrell published a letter or a note that Diana had written predicting that she could die in a car crash, an orchestrated car crash. And I sort of was surprised at that, because that she was able to not only predict that she could be killed, but in the method that could be used. And when you look at the... evidence of what occurred, that the main case that's been put is that the driver, Henry Paul, driver of the Mercedes that crashed in the Alma Tunnel, was drunk behind the wheel. And the other case that's put is that the Mercedes was being chased by the paparazzi who had forced the driver into speeding up and were basically the cause of the crash as well. So you've got two causes that have been put forward by the official investigations into the crash. And then when you actually study the evidence indicates that the driver was not drunk. You've got the witnesses at the Ritz Hotel prior to the Mercedes leaving on the journey, on the final journey. And those witnesses just categorically state that Henry Paul was sober when he got in behind the wheel, you know, and then the Ritz Hotel, where they were, the CCTV, you study the footage on that, and the experts have studied this, and this person is not drunk, you know, he's not inebriated, he's sober.
But aren't there some blood samples?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. There was an autopsy was carried out, and the blood samples showed that he was over three times the alcohol limit, and that's the basis of this case put by the authorities. But when you actually study the autopsy and the way it was conducted, there's a substantial amount of evidence showing that there were two bodies actually in the autopsy room, and that there were samples taken from Henry Paul, his body was there, and there were samples taken from a second body. And what happened is that the samples taken from the second body were used to show that the person was it was three times over the blood alcohol limit, and the samples that were taken from Henry Paul were not used for that but they were later on used years later as DNA backup. So that's what occurred, and it requires a very deep forensic analysis of what occurred, but that is how the evidence, that is what the evidence shows.
Okay, so, well, what about the paparazzi though? Because that's pretty conclusive, isn't it?
Yeah, well, with the paparazzi, well, there's no question they were at the hotel, and there's no question that they followed the Mercedes, but the issue there is that the paparazzi were riding on scooters and in small cars. Now, the witnesses who saw the Mercedes, and there's quite a few witnesses along the route, along the expressway, beside the river, and then as it went into the Alma Tunnel, and these witnesses saw the Mercedes surrounded by powerful, large motorbikes, several. So at one witness described it as a swarm, and this is what witnesses saw. So witnesses saw these powerful motorbikes, that the paparazzi, who were all accounted for from the paparazzi who were at the Ritz Hotel, that they were riding these scooters and in small cars. So they could not possibly have been these motorbikes that were seen by the witnesses. And this is where people have become very confused, you know, because if you ask the average person on the street who caused the crash, well, a lot of people will say the paparazzi, a lot of people will say Henry Paul was drunk. And at the inquest, the jury verdict was that it was unlawful killing by the driver of the Mercedes, but also unlawful killing by the following vehicles. And the following vehicles are not identified. So the people believe that the verdict was unlawful killing by the paparazzi. That's not true. And the jury were aware that these vehicles were not identified, these motorbikes. And, you know, there's been no... One of the things that's amazing about this is that following the jury's verdict that there was unlawful killing by following vehicles which were unidentified, there's been no attempt by the authorities in France or in the UK to establish the identity of the motorbike.
Well, that's a bit naughty, isn't it? Because if you've got an unlawful killing verdict, then surely the police, the authorities, should be then going to search for whoever has done that unlawful killing, whether it's murder, manslaughter, or whatever. And it's also the title, isn't it, of a film which was made by Keith Allen, paid for by Mohammed Al-Fayed, Unlawful Killing, which has virtually been almost totally censored here in Britain. What do you make? I imagine you've seen that film, John. What do you make of it?
Yeah, well, that film is by far the best sort of production, visual production on what happened, and to date. And it's an excellent documentary, and it goes into that, and it shows that it wasn't the paparazzi that were following, and it also goes into a lot of other things, including the treatment of Princess Diana in the ambulance.
SAS? I mean, there was a scandal with Danny Nightingale and other people who are ex-SAS people. I think Danny was prosecuted for having a firearm. And as part of that case, the colleagues of Danny apparently gave a letter saying that he knew who had killed Diana to his wife or to his girlfriend. And then she started talking about it publicly, and also that she'd been given and he'd been given, I think it was a paltry sum of £500 by the authorities here in Britain to keep quiet about it. What do you make about this story about the SAS soldier's letter?
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting because the police said they will do I've forgotten the word they use now, it's an unusual word, but scoping. They did some scoping on this, and they came up with a report. I think it was around Christmas 2013 when they produced it. And they, in their report, they said that they'd studied into the allegations made by the wife and also and father, and that they had found there was no case to answer, like that there was no evidence of SAS involvement in the killing of Princess Diana. But the but it was interesting that they, in their report, they said that for privacy reasons they wouldn't be able to say who they interviewed, they wouldn't be able to say what anyone said. So basically it was a report about nothing. And so why is that? Why is there a cover-up over that? And, you know, when you look at the evidence from the crash, and this came up at the inquest, that MI6, and a lot of evidence points to MI6 involvement in this, that MI6 used the SAS to carry out operations, in certain situations. And the classic situation would be if you were going to employ people to ride those motorbikes that pressured the Mercedes to going into the Alma Tunnel, because that wasn't the route. The route to the apartment was to turn off the expressway, and this Mercedes was prevented from turning off the expressway by the motorbikes. Logical and conceivable that the MI6 would employ the SAS to do that, and to do that particular part of the operation.
Well, the whole point is it's deniable, isn't it? This is what the SAS are used for, operations which are then denied. I mean, even I have spoken to military people, some of them presently still in the military, who have said that they've been, for example, doing special operations in Syria and come back home after having been into Syria. Now, if you were to ask the Ministry of Defence about that, they would just simply deny it and downing somebody. But the special forces are used, at least this is the understanding right around the world, that the places like the White House, Downing Street, sign these orders off in the knowledge that if anything is discovered, that the security services and the actual special forces themselves will deny it. And then if it's absolutely proven, that they will take the hit and they'll deny that there's been any signing off from the top, from Downing Street, the White House, or wherever. But let's just get back to the Alma Tunnel, John. The Mercedes, I notice, was actually a Mercedes which was in some ways tampered with before the crash. Just tell us what you know about the model, the mark of the Mercedes, how up-to-date it was, whether it had, you know, things like computers on board, because we know that with aircraft and cars which have computers on board, there's a possibility of hacking. I mean, you know, even examples of people sitting in the back seat of a car and actually making the car speed up and slow down and even turn left and right using a hacking device, or even just through a smartphone, to interfere with what the driver's doing. So what are your thoughts about, you know, quite how safe that Mercedes was to drive that night?
Yeah, well, it was a Mercedes S280. I've forgotten exactly which year it was. I think it was just a few years old. But the, there's restricted evidence on this. I think there was a computer on board, that's right. But there's restricted evidence on exactly the condition.
Well, if the crash took place in 1998, I would imagine it's not much more than a year old. Princess Diana's car and Dodi Alfire's car, I don't imagine it's going to be a sort of second-hand model or something.
No, it wasn't second-hand, but I'm not sure exactly the year. Yeah, it could have been a couple of them, but
yeah.
It was a backup car, you see, like the actual car that they were driving in that day, and the main car was kept out the front of the Ritz Hotel, and they used this, what they call a third car.
Okay, so the original car they were intending to use was sitting outside the Ritz, almost to distract the paparazzi's attention, making them think, well, this is the car they intend to use, and then they sort of sneak round the back with a different car.
That's right, yeah, it was a decoy. It was called the decoy plan. And the upshot of that was, of course, they ended up with no backup car, because the backup car was out the front as well. So that was one of the things that showed there was a manipulation of events, you know, because Princess Diana was meant to always have a backup car there, so that if something went wrong, then they would be transferred into the backup car and get away from the scene. But no backup car, you're very vulnerable. And so getting back to the Mercedes, one of the things that's very clear is that, and this is something that was shown in the Padgett report but not shown to the jury at the inquest, that the vehicle inspection report done by Operation Padgett, who studied the car was brought over to the UK years later, and they studied it, and that one of the seat belts, the seat belt used by Princess Diana, was it jammed in the retractable position. So that that's evidence of, this car, like you say, it's a Mercedes used by the Ritz Hotel for guests.
Sorry to interrupt you, John, but so that seatbelt, was it actually worn by Diana? Are you saying no, it can't have been because it was not operative?
That's right. It couldn't have been worn.
But I mean, you've got, surely in the back of a Mercedes, you've got several seatbelts.
Yeah, well, this is the thing that the evidence, there's not a lot of evidence on the condition, and that's one of the things. Like, see, the problem is that there was an intensive analysis done, and there's an accident report, a vehicle inspection report produced, but that's never been made public. It was never shown to the jury, and it's just been sort of hidden away. So until you saw that, and until you had access to that, then you can't know for sure. But you can know for sure that there was a problem with at least one seatbelt.
Yeah, interesting. Well, you know, you've mentioned the Padgett report there. There is quite a bit in the public domain, and also you've been handed documents as well. Leaked documents, effectively. Yes. So can you just run through the main bulk of evidence that you've trawled through to reach your conclusions, John?
Yeah, okay, well, one of the main things that really people aren't aware of is that when the Mercedes crashed into the 13th pillar of the Alma Tunnel, that two people died instantly. No, were the two people on the driver's side of the car. So that was the driver, Henry Paul, and then Dodi Fayed, who was sitting immediately behind him. Those two people died instantly. Now, that's to do with the angle that the Mercedes hit the pillar. And so the people on the driver's side were more vulnerable.
So that's actually the left-hand side of the car, isn't it? What would be the near side here in Britain, probably the off-side in Australia.
Left-hand drive, yeah, that's right.
And it's a left-hand drive car, and it's the left-hand side which was badly impacted, yeah?
That's right. So those two people died instantly. Now, the two people on the passenger side both survived. Now, Trevor S. Jones, who was the bodyguard in the front, he survived, and Princess Diana in the back, directly behind him, she survived. And Trevor S. Jones is still alive today. And he was yet in a more vulnerable position than Princess Diana because he was in the front. And the evidence indicates he was just in the process of trying to put his seatbelt on, but I don't think it was actually on. So anyway, when the medics arrived, they did an analysis of Princess Diana's head condition. It's a standard thing that's done around the world in car crashes. It's called a Glasgow Coma Scale rating, and she scored 14 out of 15 in that assessment. Now, that's a really high rating for someone who'd been in a high-speed car crash, 60 mile an hour straight into a concrete pillar. But because the Mercedes is a strong car, of course, and what happened was when the impact occurred, she wasn't wearing a seatbelt, and her body swung 180 degrees, and she was left sitting actually on the floor with her back against the front seat of the car and her legs up on the back seat. So she was in a position that she wasn't trapped. If you look at the Mercedes after the crash and before they took the roof off, you can see that the back of the car was virtually untouched, and they were opening and closing the doors, you know, the two back doors. And anyway, what happened was that the ambulance that was sent to the scene, it came, if you look at the time it left the hospital to come to the crash, it was travelling at something averaging about 6 kilometres an hour to get to the, or it might have been 8 kilometres an hour to get to the crash scene. I mean, that's ridiculous, because we all have a vision that a ambulance will travel quickly to a crash scene, you know, but this one didn't. And so, you know, did it stop? I mean, there's evidence that the ambulance was controlled by the people who were involved in organising the crash. So did it stop on the way for instructions? Whatever. Something happened that kept that ambulance from getting to the crash scene. It left the hospital about just a few minutes after the crash, and it arrived at the crash scene at 12:40, and it was not a long distance. I don't remember the exact distance, but it was quite short. So then you've got a situation where it takes 1 hour 43 minutes for Princess Diana to arrive at the hospital, and that's a hell of a long time. You know, even in France, like people say, oh well, in France they have a different system, and they have a doctor on board in the ambulance, which is true. That they do have a different system, and they call it stay and play, whereas in the other countries like the UK, US, and Australia, it's called scoop and run, where they'll just pick up the person, the patient, and get them into the ambulance and rush them off to hospital. But in this particular situation, Diana, they got her into the ambulance after some time, and then they did an inspection, which is standard, and they saw thoracic trauma, and that's actually in the notes from the ambulance report, that she had thoracic trauma. Now, any doctor would know, and these guys are emergency doctors, so they're used to going to car crashes, that that if a person is involved in a high-speed car crash not wearing a seatbelt, and then they've got thoracic trauma, that there's very likely there's going to be some sort of internal damage, which there was in the case of Princess Diana. And they know that unless you get that person to the hospital, that they can't do anything in the ambulance. They can't deal with any sort of torn vessels. She had a torn pulmonary vein. Well, absolutely impossible for them to deal with. But instead of that, they kept delaying. They would have known that there was some internal damage, but based on the thoracic trauma and their knowledge of what occurred, the high-speed car crash, and they would have, if the doctors were doing the right thing, they would have then realised straight away, well, we can't deal with this in the ambulance. You can't fix an internal problem like a torn vessel in the ambulance. So then you've got to get the person to the hospital. And you can tell from the transcripts of the messages going back and forth, or the conversations with the base, with the ambulance base. The base is saying, well, haven't you left the tunnel yet? When are you leaving? You know, and they were saying, well, in a few minutes. But then it took another, you know, 20, 25 minutes or whatever. But anyway, all up was 1 hour 43 minutes. And so, but on top of that, there's, in the transcript it also says, nothing for the thorax. So the doctor in the ambulance is telling the base, nothing for the thorax. Now they know there's a thoracic trauma. Why are they saying nothing for the thorax? They said it twice to the base. And you know, you have an expectation that doctors in an ambulance are going to be telling the base what the problems are, not what problems aren't there. And so the reason they would do that is if they wanted to get to the hospital and make sure that the hospital hadn't called in their cardiothoracic specialist who was in the middle of the night, who was at home asleep. And that's exactly what happened. They got to the hospital and there was no cardiothoracic specialist on hand. And so there's just the other thing they did, they were pouring in the catecholamines, which is something that is used to increase the blood pressure. Now, her blood pressure was on the low side, and the specialist at the inquest said, well, you know, at that blood pressure of 70, you would just put the foot on the accelerator and get the person to the hospital. But that's not what these people did. They decided to pour in these catecholamines, knowing full well, and a doctor would know full well, that any catecholamines poured in like that over a long period is going to put any much more pressure on any tear or any problem, internal problem. And, you know, like I said before, she had a torn pulmonary vein, so doing that was just exacerbating the internal problem.
Just going back to the question I asked a bit earlier, which is your sources for your books. What were the main sources, the investigations and the leaks that you've got?
Yeah, sure. The sources are mainly the official evidence, like the inquest itself, which ran for 6 months and 7,000 pages of transcripts, and then also the Paget report, which I think was 832 pages. And then there was also...
That was a British police report, was it?
Yes, that's right, yes. And then also there was the... a whistleblower who leaked several hundred documents to me that were from within the British police investigation, Paget, and that they came to me in 2010 after I'd published a couple of volumes of the Diana Inquest series. Those documents were pretty critical.
Have you been able to verify those?
Oh yeah, they're absolutely. There are things like the post-mortem reports for Princess Diana and Dodi Fayed, which the jury were prevented from seeing. So, you know, the jury were expected to establish the cause of death. That's what their job is, to establish the cause of death.
I mean, I think you've made a very good case, really, for it being an assassination. You mentioned MI6. Who were MI6 people in Paris that weekend then?
Okay, well, the one who was headed the operation was Sherard Cooper-Coles, or Cooper-Coles, I think as it's pronounced. And he was brought into Paris just within 2 weeks of when the crash occurred.
And what evidence have you got that he was actually involved though? I mean, he could have been just having a holiday there or something.
No, well, I mean, it's very complex to establish which people were involved, but there's evidence there that certainly just that he was brought in at a very late stage and that he was the head of the political department there. So, no, he wasn't on a holiday. No, he was...
Right, you're talking about the British Embassy?
Yes, in the British Embassy, yes.
Okay, and what about motives? You know, there must be motives. I mean, I would suggest possibly people talk about landmines, don't they? They talk about possibly the Dodi Al-Fayed being quite an important, and Mohammed Al-Fayed being quite important campaigners, pro-Palestinian campaigners. What are your thoughts about what the crux of the motive was?
Yeah, well, landmines, I think, plays a very important role. I mean, she was upsetting people in high places. That's basically the issue. And off the landmines, she was upsetting people in high places. She was she had a very powerful, and people probably forget, but she was a powerful woman. And when you saw the footage of her walking through the minefields in Angola and in Bosnia, these images went right around the world, and I can remember them here in Australia, and she had the power to influence public opinion. And so, I mean, you know, the authorities would have known that she wasn't going to stop at landmines. If she'd got rid of all the landmines, then she'd be working on other weapons, you know. So you've got that aspect of it, and then the other aspect is, yeah, Mohammed Al-Fayed, the relationship of him taking the boys, the future king, to a holiday at Mohammed Al-Fayed's villa in south of France. That was Mohammed Al-Fayed, he was sort of anathema at that time. He had been involved in the Cash for Questions that had brought down, or helped bring down, Tory government in May 1997. And so that upset no doubt senior royals, you know, and and no doubt a lot of other people. I mean, it was very controversial at the time. If you look at the media reports of the assessments about Princess Diana going there for a holiday, you know, and then the ensuing relationship with Dodi, and then, you know, that you could have a Muslim stepfather to the future king.
Have you come across any evidence that she was pregnant, John?
Yeah, there is evidence. Yeah, there is evidence that she could have been pregnant. I don't think pregnant for very long. I think for probably a fairly short period, but probably, you know, there's things like when a person has a car crash and arrives at the hospital, then blood tests are taken. You know, that's just a normal thing, and yet there's no evidence of any blood test that has come forward. So that's
interesting. They may have actually found that she was pregnant. Who knows? I mean, the whole thing does sound a little bit medieval, doesn't it? It's almost like the princes in the tower. What do you think the role of the royal family was? Because I know they had something called the Way Ahead Group, didn't they? Which was looking at how the royal family was going to survive despite Diana.
Yeah, that's right.
What was this Way Ahead Group? Who was on it, and what was its mission?
Yeah, the Way Ahead Group was co-chaired by the Queen and the Lord Chamberlain, And that was that consisted of senior members of the royal family, so, and then all of their private secretaries, and so they would meet twice a year. One of the things that's very interesting about this is that at the inquest, the private secretaries of the Queen, who was Robert Fellows, and the private secretary of Prince Philip, whose name escapes me at the moment, but you know, both those guys gave a substantial amount of evidence. They were cross-examined instead of the royal family themselves being cross-examined, which is what should have happened, as they were the suspects. But these guys were cross-examined over the Way Ahead Group, and they just consistently said, no, the Way Ahead Group, all it is was a organisation set up, or a committee set up to sort out the royal timetables, you know, and establish that there was no conflicts with royal family engagements. So this counters against about at that stage, I think it was about 13 years. It was set up in 1992, the Way Ahead Group. 13 years of press reports saying that the Way Ahead Group was set up to deal with major issues facing the royal family. So that was a huge conflict there, and all the evidence points to the Way Ahead Group being a very, very powerful committee that is used to address issues facing the royal family. So even if the royal family wasn't involved in this, I mean, if the royal family wasn't involved in this, why would the private secretaries try and cover up the purpose of the Way Ahead Group? And, you know, they said, oh, well, Diana wasn't discussed. Well, it's obvious that Diana was a problem to the royal family. Whether or not they're involved in the assassination is beside the point. If the fact is this was set up to deal with major issues facing the royal family, and it's obvious that Diana would have come up as a discussion point in the committee, and yet there was this complete denial. I call it excessive distancing, where they come up with something that totally removes the possibility, because all the Way Ahead Group would deal with was royal engagements. So
now, is there any evidence that the Way Ahead Group was discussing things like Diana and Dodi's trip to the south of France with William and Harry?
Yeah, well, you know, in July there was a special meeting of the Way Ahead Group. Normally they met in January and September each year, and in that year, 1997, there was a special meeting in July. And that's very unusual. And just ahead of that meeting, 3 days ahead, there was a press article, obviously from a leak from someone in the royal household, saying that Diana was the top of the agenda at the next Way Ahead Group meeting on the 23rd of July. So, I mean, these leaks, they don't come out of thin air.
Well, of course, I mean, that was the time that all this would have been being discussed. So, I mean, was the coroner at the inquest, was the coroner asking questions about the cross-examining fellows and other personal private secretaries to the Duke of Edinburgh and the Queen, saying, well, hang on, we've got evidence here, you were talking about Diana at the Way Ahead group?
Yeah, well, the coroner wasn't, but the other, some of the lawyers like Michael Mansfield were, and but basically, it was just denial, 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 you know. Oh, no, Diana was never discussed. No, no, no. You know, there wasn't much interest in her. And they said, oh, the Queen and Philip weren't that much interested in her, you know, at that stage. I mean, she had been turfed out of the royal family in August 1996, but she had become a thorn in their side. And, you know, so you've got press leaks saying that, and then... you've got the private secretary saying, no, no, it's all just nothing.
Well, somebody's lying, aren't they? The other thing, of course, is we've got the VIP paedophile scandal now really erupting here in Britain with all sorts of denials. The BBC, of course, very much associated with Jimmy Savile, denying it. I wonder, do you think that there's a better atmosphere to discuss and criticise these things in Australia, John?
Yeah, it could be. I mean, I'm a long way away. I think that it's probably harder. It's harder if you're living in the UK. I'm absolutely certain of that. I detect that there's a fair bit of fear of people stepping out of line in the UK, and it's very brave people that are prepared to speak out or cover issues. Even you being prepared to do this interview, I think, you know, there's courageous people like you around, and thank God for that, because, you know, if there wasn't these people are prepared to ask the right questions, then they wouldn't get asked in the UK anyway.
Also, you know, I know you're not too well, are you? Can you just tell us a bit about your illness? Because, you know, as far as I know, you're actually going downhill a bit at the moment, John, which is a pity. And maybe you'd just like to tell us about what's been happening.
Yeah, sure. Well, I've got an illness called multiple system atrophy, which is a neurological disorder which causes autonomic dysfunction right through the body. And so all of these things that the brain does automatically, the brain controls all the organs through the body, all of those automatic controls, like keeping the stomach working, you get sort of the brain causing the signals to push food through the stomach and that sort of thing. All those things have shut down. So I basically... It makes life very, very difficult, and it's become more difficult and more painful. And so I've reached a point where I've had to cut down on my food and intake, and so I'm becoming weaker. And so my days are numbered, Tony, I'm afraid.
Well, I think they are for everybody. We all ought to remember that, but maybe a little bit more for you, John. Also, I just wonder what your thoughts are about the, you know, conclusion to all of this. Do you think we'll see justice, or is it going to be just like medieval times, where the, you know, young princes can be murdered and the royal family get away with it?
Yeah, well, I've got a gut feeling that this is a bit different, because you've got William and Harry there, and I really feel, see, William at some stage, he'll become the king, and I feel that, you know, as a son and not just, see, he's not completely as royal as the others have been, because Diana really put in an effort to try and raise these boys differently, and I think she is pretty successful in that, considering what she was up against. So, you know, I feel that William will want to establish what occurred in Paris, and at some future point when he's got the power to do so, that may happen. It's whether the gut impact on him being her son or being a king, you know, whichever is the most powerful. But it's hard to imagine that these guys don't want to know the full story of what occurred.
Yeah, well, the whole story really smacks of misrule, doesn't it? Bad rulers, anti-democratic. I mean, how does that fit in with what's going on in the rest of the world and for our future, John?
Yeah, well, that's right. You sort of you know, if things are not modernised, it's just hard to imagine how the system can keep going how it has, you know, and you let murders like what happened to Princess Diana occur. It's just, you know, we're in the 21st century, you like to think that things have improved, but, you know, there's all sorts of things going on, of course, in the world, and we all know, or a lot of us know, that things are not as they seem. You know.
It's a bit. Well, if you could recommend one of your books as a fairly short one, which has got quite a lot of the information in that people can follow up with other books if they want to, but it's got the, you know, the whole thing in a nutshell, which is the best one, John?
Yeah, well, there's two books, really. Paris-London Connection, The Assassination of Princess Diana. That book is a real short summary. It's less than 200 pages. It's a fast, easy read book. And then the second book, which I only just finished last year, just finished before it was too late, and that's called How They Murdered Princess Diana, The Shocking Truth. Now, that book is an 800-page book, but it's also a narrative and easy-to-read book, and it covers a lot of the evidence. So whereas the short book doesn't cover the evidence, this book does include a lot of the evidence. So it's hard to come away from reading that second book without understanding that something drastically bad went on and who was involved. Mm.
You're an investigative journalist. Maybe you could just tell us a bit about your background as an investigative journalist and whether you think this time you've got the job done.
Yeah, well, I feel as though the job's done. I get a lot of feedback from people who have been very appreciative of the books that have been written, and it really is a forensic analysis. Six of the books I've written 10 books on the death of Princess Diana. Six of them are a detailed forensic investigative aspects of the crash and the events surrounding it. And it's a very complex case, but this has really sort of helped highlight what occurred. And I couldn't have written that last book unless I'd done those six volumes. And that last book puts them all together in an easy narrative. So, you know, I'm quite pleased with the work I've done, and I'm pleased that people from reading the books are learning what happened, and it's been a huge cover-up. There's massive forces trying to cover this up, and it's so I'm pleased that I've had a role in that.
And just give us an idea of something that you investigated before the whole Diana case landed on your plate.
Yeah, I did. I was brought up in a fundamentalist religious cult, Christian, but cult, and that was very, very strongly sort of restrictive and fundamental. And so I wrote a book about that called Flying Free. And it helped me to fly free because I was in it for 35 years, so it had a huge impact on my life. So I do have a sort of interest in the truth because I can see how the truth got suppressed in that cult, and I can see it happens in other parts of or other organisations.
So do you think there's a cult-like aspect to the royal family? I mean, some would say things like the Order of the Garter is almost like a kind of cult of some sort. What are your thoughts about that?
Yeah, I absolutely feel that it's run like a cult. Yeah, it is, I think. And, you know, it's a very pressurised system. Diana was sort of, you know, it was just, you just can't imagine how difficult it is for someone in her position. The way she was set up with the marriage of Charles, the complete failure of the third person in the marriage, and Camilla, and just the pressure that was on her with the media constantly following her every move and just going through the dreadful.
I mean, what are the characteristics of a cult? How would you single it out from another, say, a golf club or something?
It's mind control, really. It's brainwashing. I mean, you know, what happens is you can't leave a cult. That's one of the key things, I suppose, that you can't. Most cults, you can't leave them, you know. Whether religious, they'll say, well, you know, you'll end up in hellfire. And the thing is that this sounds, to a person who hasn't been in a cult, they can't understand it, but it sounds sort of ridiculous. But the thing is that when you're in a cult or you're brought up in it, like someone in the royal family is, then you absolutely believe it. You believe it to your to your every fibre of your body, you believe what you've taught. So if you believe that you're going to end up in hellfire if you leave the cult, you won't leave it. And that's what the issue is, I suppose. It's mind control. So whereas a golf club will let you have different thoughts, basically your thoughts are controlled when you're in a cult.
And how about cult leaders? I mean, surely, there's someone's got to be running these cults.
Yeah, they're mainly crooks, unfortunately, yeah. And they're con men, con women, or whoever it is that's in charge of the... they basically, they've worked. There's a formula for cults, and most of them are pretty similar when you study them. And I did study them when I did that book.
Freemasonry, for example, Edward the Seventh certainly was a Freemason. George the Sixth was a Freemason. Is that the sort of thing you're talking about?
Oh, I think so. Yeah, I haven't studied Freemasonry, but I get that impression. Yeah. Similar, yeah.
Okay, John, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect, and very much best wishes for your health for the future.
Yeah, thanks very much, Tony. I appreciate you interviewing me.
And God bless, of course.
Okay, thanks.
All right, John, cheers. Bye-bye. That's all for this week. Dialect is the MP3 podcast. If you're online, you could subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Paul Saville, who's standing for Mayor of Bristol next year, that's 2016. Also to Sabine McNeil from victimsunite.net, and to John Morgan, author of several books on the Diana assassination. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. Just contact us through Volunteering Bristol 0117 989 7733 or at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.